Look at this piece of paper. See this piece of paper? Look at that one. Okay. So, as we start Revelation, this is the this is really, really good explanation. So this is the best explanation I've seen in a chart form of the different views, because I've talked to you about amillennialism and postmillennialism and all that kind of stuff, premillennialism. This is in the chart form. How do I look at Revelation? So let's start at the bottom and work our way up. Okay? So I thought you're supposed to start at the top. Yeah, it's my Sunday school class. I'm going to do it the way I want. So I'm joking a little bit, but I think the bottom one is pretty much the easiest one for us to throw away. Okay? So this is the idealist. That means Revelation is about timeless principles. Revelation isn't talking about a specific time. It is talking about a pattern of events or trends that will be repeated through history as an encouragement to God's people of all times who face persecution. In that sense, it's a timeless message. In other words, it doesn't mean anything. It just means, hey, Christian people are going to have problems, but we win. I could have written the book a lot shorter. And I'm not sure how that falls in the category of, remember what John says? It's a revelation of Jesus Christ. So Jesus Christ went on for 22 chapters and gave specific numbers like 144,000. We're going to see today, if we get to it, the four living creatures that are the same creatures that are in Isaiah and Ezekiel. When Isaiah and Ezekiel see God's throne, they're the same. So you have to believe then that Isaiah and Ezekiel's prophecies meant nothing. The downhill effect of this idea is, well, then, does anything in the Bible mean anything? I mean, is it just all about timeless principles that, yay, good people win, bad people lose? I mean, where do you draw the line that Revelation is like that? But salvation, the virgin birth, the deity of Christ, I mean, everything else that you believe in that is factual, that we just basically turn into allegory. Remember, I've talked to you about allegory. We just turn this into allegory, but we can trust the rest of it. Except the allusions in Revelation, as we'll see to the four living beasts, are the exact same four living beasts in Isaiah and Ezekiel that are around the throne. So now you're going to throw out chunks of Isaiah and Ezekiel. Where does it stop? And how do you develop a principle that says it stops here? Well, this is how we get to, I'm not trying to be mean, but this is how we get to transgenderism. This is how we get to homosexuality. Well, you can't trust, that doesn't mean what it means. Well, then does this mean, well, I guess it doesn't mean what it means. Well, then this doesn't mean, that's, to me, to any conservative or to any Bible believer, frankly, this is just ludicrous. That's why I started with it. It's the easiest to say ludicrous too, in my opinion. Comment or question about that, you go, wow, after the pastor called it ludicrous, I'm not going to ask him a question. No, but seriously, do you understand my point? In saying it. Does that make sense? Okay. History. This is the historist view. So Revelation is all about history. There's a reason I'm starting at the bottom. Revelation describes the key events of history stretching from the death and resurrection of Jesus to the return as judge. It can be seen as a timetable by which we can interpret the signs of the times. In other words, world events today are described in Revelation. So this would be somewhat okay. We'll get to the one that I believe in, which is futurist. But so historist says it's about all times. It does have literal interpretation, but it's about all times. My suggestion would be that it's written to the early church, second and third century. We'll see this. The second and third chapters are written to those seven churches to tell us what's in the future, even from us. Now, will there be wars and rumors of wars? Yeah, for sure. But the context of Matthew 24 and 25 is to a question, what will be the sign of your coming? So, yes, there'll always be wars and rumors of wars. hey, as you're coming in, there's two sheets of paper on the stand. You want to get both of them? You want to get both of them as you come in. So the historist would say that Revelation is both applicable to the year 1000, the year 800, the year 700. The difficulty I have with that, while it does say there's future events that it predicts, the difficulty I have with that is, but that's not in the timeline. John sees heaven and then beasts are let loose. Okay, I mean, the trumpets blow, the seals are undone. We'll get to all that. If you're seeing it as a historist, it means that, again, it's principles that apply to all generations. And I just struggle to say things like that because as someone who believes in a grammatical, literal, historical interpretation of Scripture, tell me any other book in the Bible we interpret like that. There isn't one. There isn't one. So, again, if you're going to interpret, why would you interpret Revelation differently than the other 65 books? I would suggest it's probably not the best choice, although I appreciate with the historists that we can interpret signs of the time. In other words, world events today are described in Revelation. Again, I appreciate that they're actually trying to there are literal events that this talks about. That's good. It's not just allegorized. But Revelation was written for hereafter. And why we place it as Daniel's 70th week, which dealing with the Jews, is because you don't see the church. You don't see a Gentile church in Revelation. It is 144,000 Jews. We'll get to that chapter, right? But it's 144,000 Jews. If you've read Revelation, you know it's coming, right? Those 144,000 Jews, it doesn't talk about a Gentile church being the missionary. This is an Acts of the Apostles. Right? There's no Gentile church. Where's the Gentile? The Gentile church stops in Revelation 3. Revelation 2 and 3, the Gentile church. You don't, from 4 on, you don't see the Gentile church until the great white throne judgment. And the dead and great, the small and dead, and they all stood before God. Revelation 20 verses 11 to 15. So you don't see us there. That's the problem I have with the historist view. So let's go to preterist. I'm going to skip the one I would hold to, which is futurist. Let's go to the preterist. So this is what we would call postmillennial and even amillennial. So this is the one that would say all the events in Revelation happened before 70 AD. Remember, I've talked about that a bit. So the events described in Revelation all took place around the time of the letter's writing and should be read with the historical context in mind. In other words, the letter was written first and foremost to Christians in the first century under Roman rule and persecution. As such, we need to understand how they would have originally read it before applying it to ourselves. Okay, so the only application for us, even though the promises we get to them in Revelation 22 are don't take a word away, don't add a word, or all the curses in this book will be laid on you, if you've read that at the end of Revelation 22. Revelation has a special promise found really nowhere else in the Bible. Understanding these words, there's a special blessing to understand these words that really is found nowhere else in the New Testament. So that all those kind of unique things for Revelation, blessing and don't delete a word and don't add a word and curses and all that kind of stuff, are just about something that happened in 70 AD. And I thought this was supposed to be a revelation of Jesus Christ, of his power. So they would say, well, it is. The church is his revelation. The church has replaced Israel, and now the church is the power. I come back to them and say, well, you have a problem then with the 144,000 Jews. God has a specific number and specific tribes that he's preserved people for. So is God just throwing numbers at a wall and they just mean, so the Jews really aren't Jews in any specific tribe? So they would interpret those, since the church is the Israel of God, those aren't really tribes in the sense we think of tribes. I'm like, whoa, wait a second. How did the first readers interpret this? They knew of the tribes of Israel. John is writing this. John's a Jew. John's from the tribe of Judah. He's a Jew. They all knew about the Jewish tribes. So John writes and talks about the dispersed tribes and 12,000 that have been preserved, and he doesn't mean it. He means something else. Well, then why didn't he write what he meant? Is that tracking? Is everybody tracking? Does that make sense? Are you following me? Okay. So the futurist view says the events described in Revelation are predicated to take place in the far distant future from the people that heard it first. And bear in mind, we're starting at chapter 4 with this view. This isn't chapter 2 and 3. Chapter 2 and 3 is written to generally a persecuted or lukewarm churches. One is very missionary minded. Most of them have good and bad, and a couple of them are just bad. And remember, Eusebius, the early church pastors, all date this book to 90. It's only when you come into a theology hundreds of years later that the church replaces Israel, there's no future for Israel, that then we have to push Revelation back to 70 and come up with this view that the events of Revelation are not future to the reader, but they're in the past to the reader, or they're current to the reader. In other words, John writes this in 67 or 68 about the Romans besieging Jerusalem, and the great beast that rises up is Vespasian and his son Titus that sacks Jerusalem. And this is all about, well, how do you get to the bowl vial, the trumpets and the vials, and a 200 million man army coming out of the east, and a third of the people on the planet all die? Those don't mean anything. God is just throwing mud at a wall, and his numbers don't mean anything. There's nothing real about those numbers. He's just making stuff up to say lots of stuff. I guarantee you, when the sack of Jerusalem, a third of the people of the earth, a third of the people of the earth didn't die. Now, a lot of Jews died, but nobody in China died. Nobody in France died. So in other words, numbers don't mean numbers. And the danger of doing that is, yes, God uses metaphors, and yes, God uses examples, and yes, God uses you can use a number that means infinite, like thousands of thousands of thousands of angels. The literal Greek is innumerable host. Okay, so English, we translate it thousands upon thousands upon thousands. Okay, innumerable host, whatever. But there has to be an actual reality behind all that verbiage. Because if there's not, you're first of all, then God doesn't mean what he says. And then second of all, where do you stop saying God doesn't really mean what he says? Well, Jesus was born of a virgin. Well, God doesn't really mean what he says. Right? Warner, you had your hand up and I kept talking. Go ahead.
So British Israelism, that's the same as
replace. Yes. And to be honest with you, that was a cult that was very popular in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And even into the 70s, but it's not. That it just really is. It's a little bit like postmillennialism. After World War I and World War II, you couldn't find a postmillennialist. Because a postmillennialist says, Satan is bound. We're all going to come to, the whole world is going to turn to Jesus. We're all going to win people to Christ. Or we'll make government so good that governments will enforce, like what we call theonomists today. And World War I and World War II, When the planet goes for 6 years with a million dead every month for 6 years, somehow just man looking at that goes, I'm not sure Satan's really bound. When our troops walked into Dachau and to Buchenwald, if you've ever seen Band of Brothers and the scenes where they walk into that concentration camp, it's hard to convince that generation that Satan was bound when you see the horrific evil. Now, of course, because it's happening in the East, nobody talked about the Soviet Union purposely starving 5 million Ukrainians to death in 1932 and 1933 because the New York Times was writing puff pieces about Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union. And you can see that. There are articles in 32, 33, 34 in the New York Times talking about what a great leader Joseph Stalin was. Meanwhile, he was starving 5 million Ukrainians purposely to death. So it wasn't in the West, it's in the East. And you know, 5 million people in the East dying is not nearly as important as people in the West dying. I'd say that purely tongue-in-cheek. I hope you understand that. I'm being very sarcastic. So that, you know, if that answers, I talked a little bit longer about that. But so that's the problem in my mind with this preacherist view, and it's coming back and becoming very popular. The idea in the Southern Baptist Convention, probably half your pastors are preacherists. They believe in postmillennialism. That's why you see the support for Israel dropping in America, especially amongst 20 and 30-somethings, because so many 20 and 30-something evangelicals are no longer dispensationalists. They're postmillennial preacherists, not futurists. It all goes to their theology. And if the church has replaced Israel, then, oh, if Israel is no better, the nation is no better than Hamas. Okay, this is a great chart for you to understand the book of Revelation. I am coming at it from I'll be very honest, I come to it from a futurist position. Okay, chapters 1, 2, and 3 were about those churches in that time. There are great principles for us. I preached them that way. If you weren't here and you want to go hear those seven sermons, I preached on those seven sermons. Starting with 4:1, as we saw, he says twice, the sense is hereafter. These things are hereafter. Twice in 4:1. He was caught up into heaven, and he's told you're going to see things hereafter. Remember that? Remember we talked about that? Okay. Comment or question about that? I'll put my water down. So if you want to look at Revelation, I'm in Acts. Let me flip over to Revelation. Just to make my point, I think I've pounded that puppy into the ground. After verse 1, after these things, so after chapter 2 and 3, after these things, behold, a door opened in heaven, and the first voice which I heard was like a trumpet speaking to me, come up here, and I will show you things which must take place after this. Future. Future. So he says, after these things, the first three words, and then at the end, it's the last two words, after this. So it's future. He doesn't say before this. He doesn't say, I'm going to show you principles. He says, I'm going to show you events. I'm going to show you things which must take place after this. These are not principles. He's going to show you things that must take place. So in my mind, only the historist and the futurist even are plausibilities. The last one, we would call it the idealist. No. And the preacherist, you just have to upend actual history and what the early church pastors, when they placed the dating of this book, is a long time after the destruction of Jerusalem. So just like this postmillennialist I told you about last week, and his long thread on X or Twitter is, this is one the dispensationalists can't get around. If the temple was destroyed, John didn't talk about it. There's no way around that. John would have had to have talked about it. First of all, logically, you can't make an argument from silence. You know, just because I don't tell you every single day that I love my wife doesn't mean I don't love my wife. That's an argument from silence. Now, men, don't be silent telling your wife never that you love her. It's a good thing to tell your wife that you love her. That's not what I'm saying. But if I miss a day of telling my wife I love her, it's not fair to say, well, obviously, since you didn't tell your wife you loved her today, it means you don't. That's an argument from silence. That's a logic fallacy. Okay. So it's an unfair argument from silence. And then the other argument is simply, if God didn't inspire him to talk about something that had happened 20 years before, he wouldn't write it down. Listen, how many of you, honestly, be really honest with me, because I don't know if you've ever had these thoughts. I have these thoughts when I read the Bible. How many of you would like to have more stories about Jesus when he was a little kid? I mean, really, wouldn't our Sunday school classes be really much cooler? I mean, if we had more, and you know where you find those? In the Apocrypha, him raising birds to life. There's all kinds of apocryphal stories about Jesus. Birds died and he touched them and they all came back to life. They're not true. That's why we call them apocryphal books. And the terminology, it's an apocryphal story, right? Because it's... Yes. So there's 14 books in, now you'll love this, in the original King James Version that's supposed to be inspired. There were 14 books between the Old and New Testament, and they were included in the original 1611. So it not only wasn't inspired, they added 14 books. Now, my King James only friends would say, oh, but they knew they weren't inspired. Then why did they put them in the Bible? And by the way, I have a copy of the original King James Version, and there is no disclaimer in front of those apocryphal books. These are not inspired. And the Anglican Church today still holds, just like the Catholic Church, holds to the Anglican Church. Of course, the Anglican Church today doesn't even believe the Bible's inspired, so that's kind of an off, very conservative Anglicans do, but the mainline Anglican doesn't even believe the Bible's inspired. But there's no disclaimer there. It's a very difficult point for King James only to get around, and they dodge and they weave and try to get around it. So it was about the third edition of the King James revision that they pulled those out. But the original 1611 had, and in those apocryphal books, they're all kind of cool stories about Jesus. As a child, go read them. They're kind of cool. It's a little bit like watching Bluey. Anybody here watch Bluey? If you have grandchildren that are 3 or 4 or 5, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Or if you have children that age. Bonnie, you know Bluey, don't you? Yeah. So we were watching Bluey, Tickle Monster, and Daddy becomes Tickle Monster. And so Ellie and Theo love Pop-Pop, and Dad had to be Tickle Monster. So after Bluey, we did Tickle Monster for 5 minutes. And they're having so much fun. Ellie even sticks her foot in my lap so I can tickle it. When I get done and she's done laughing, and I'm like, okay, I've had enough. She sticks her foot back in my lap, so I have to tickle her foot some more, you know. So, okay. So, comments about anything there before I jump in and go further in the actual text. I want to get you up to 35,000 feet, tell you what I believe, and then I'll take you in the weeds and you'll see why I believe that. Okay? Not that the Word of God is the weeds. That's not what I meant. I'll get down into the details. Let me use a different metaphor. Okay? Okay, great. Verse 5, the 24 elders, lots of different ideas there, but my understanding, a lot of good commentators, it doesn't matter. This is not a point of division or anything like that. My understanding of the 24 elders is they represent the completion of the church, that the church is now raptured and in heaven. And we talked about how the number 24 had a symbol of completion in the Old Testament with the courses of the priest. I think that's the best interpretation. I probably read 7 or 8 commentaries on this, and I had 6 different opinions. So there's a lot of opinions out there about who those 24 elders are. I'm going to, as I interpret this, I'm going to give you my, I'll go with that interpretation. If I'm wrong, it's, you know, Jesus can forgive me, and the 24 elders can, I'll ask their forgiveness when I see them. So anyway, verse 6. Before the throne, there was a sea of glass like crystal, and in the midst of the throne and around the throne were 4 living creatures full of eyes in front and in back. So if you look at my notes, I say the sea of glass is likely a picture of peace. Now, there again, if you read 8 commentators on this, you'll come up with like 19 different opinions. I mean, seriously, they're like all over the place. My understanding is there's 2 possibilities that I like the best. One is it's a sign of peace, a sea of glass. What does the Bible say? The wicked are like the sea, riven with the wind and tossed. The wicked are all often viewed. Remember, the Jews were not great naval people. That was the Lebanese. That was the Phoenicians. And so the sea was kind of a scary thing to the Jews. That's why Jonah going to the sea is unique. Sea was kind of scary to them. They were land, mountain, in the hills people. So Jews often viewed sea travel as dangerous, and they used it as a metaphor of the wicked. Do we see that today in America with everybody on anxiety? Everybody's anxious. Our country has become much more wicked, and it's become much more anxious. A characteristic of the wicked, and that doesn't mean you don't sometimes have worry. The Bible tells us not to worry, but we're human, and we worry. And we give that to God, and then sometimes we take it back, and then we have to give it to God again, and then we take it back, and then we have to give it to God again, and we take it back. That's not what I'm talking about. But to the person that doesn't know Christ, there is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked, right? I mean, I can't. So my thought is the most likely understanding of the sea of glass is that it's a picture of peace. You're in heaven. There's no war. There's no sin. There's no death. God's in 100% control. There's no worry. There's no anxiousness. It's a sea of glass. It's not churning. It could be a symbol also of believers in heaven, as sometimes sea is a picture of humanity. We'll see in Revelation 13 that the Antichrist is going to ride, the beast is going to come up out of the sea. There are different times that sea is used in the Bible as a metaphor of humanity. If that metaphor here is humanity, then it's a picture of the church, which I think the elders are a symbol of that. We'll get to that why of that in a second. But it's a picture of all the believers of the church are there, and we're all at peace. Wouldn't it be great to be relieved from sin, temptation to sin, to evil, to health concerns? I wake up in the morning and stretch and stretch and stretch. I've got a belt now, and I've got these two dogs, and I've got a belt, and I take them out walking, and I stretch my, because they pull me. I mean, I'm going like this through my neighborhood as these standard poodle and a golden poodle, a golden retriever poodle, and they love to go for walks. If you say the word walk, they know that word. I don't know if you have a dog that knows the word walk. My dogs know the word walk, and the other day I said to Dave, do you think I should take the dogs for WALK? And they both ran at me. I go, my goodness, my dogs can spell. They're better than the average high school student in Denver, Colorado. They can spell, you know. And yeah, some of you got that. Some of you missed that. So I tend to favor the former over the latter understanding. But I think it could be a combination of both. It could be the church in heaven is at peace. The church in heaven is at peace. But there are a lot of other interpretations that are just fine as well. Yep. It could be a literal surface with no symbolism at all. 100% can. Yeah, absolutely. And that is actually an interpretation. Okay, the four living creatures. I've got a few minutes left. The four living creatures are linked to Isaiah's seraphim and Ezekiel's cherubim. Okay, hold your finger here. Let's go read. So let's get in our head. Now remember, Isaiah and Ezekiel. Ezekiel is written in captivity in Babylon around 560 BC. Isaiah was written to the southern kingdom in Judah around 800 BC. So there's about 250 years between Isaiah and Ezekiel. And now if John is writing in 90, you get the idea. If this is 700 years removed from Isaiah, and 600 plus years removed from Ezekiel. Long time. They both see heaven, right? Revelation 4, after these things, and behold the door standing in heaven, and the voice, and he's caught up into heaven, and he sees the vision of heaven. Okay, so let's go to Isaiah 6. It's relatively familiar. I wouldn't be surprised if you've been saved for a long time if you haven't heard a message on Isaiah 6. So let's look at Isaiah's called to the ministry, and he's going to be rebuking Judah for their sin. And he starts off Isaiah chapter 6 and verse 3. Verse 1, he says, in the year that King Uzziah died, so we know exactly when the prophecy takes place, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne. So he's caught up into heaven the same way John is. High and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple, and above it stood seraphim. Okay, these are high-ranking angels. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face, two he covered his feet, and two he flew. So holy ground, You can't look on God. Every time when Moses is at the burning bush, what does God say to do about his shoes? Take your shoes off. You're on holy ground. Okay? So he says, two, he covered his feet, two, he flew, and he cried, holy, holy, holy. You're going to see the same thing in John. This is one reason if you're just going to say we win or it's all in the past. These are identical visions. Chapter 4 of John and Isaiah 6, they are seeing the same temple, the same throne room in heaven, 700 years apart. Okay? The whole earth is filled with his glory, and the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke. And so I said, woe is me, I'm done, undone. The point is verse 3. And one cried to another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is filled with his glory. So when we get to Revelation in a second, if this doesn't, is the scene is just very, it's identical. Okay? So let's skip over to Ezekiel. I won't read this longer passage because Ezekiel goes into even greater detail. Is Ezekiel 1, I believe, in my notes? I have a semicolon there. It should be a colon. Yes. I'm sorry. It's a semicolon in the notes, and it should be a colon if you're looking at that. So now notice how he describes it. So Ezekiel is writing 250 years after Isaiah. Ezekiel's in Babylonian captivity. He's living in Babylon, about 75 miles, 100 miles north of Daniel, who is in the city of Babylon. And in verse 5, also from within it came the likeness of how many living creatures? Four. I lost my place. Then I looked and behold the whirlwind, verse 5. And also within came light for living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. Each one had four faces, and each one had four wings. Their legs were straight. Soles of their feet were like the soles of calves' feet. They sparkled like the color of burnished bronze. The hands of a man were under their wings on their four sides, and each of the four had faces and wings. Their wings touched one another. The creatures did not turn when they went, but each one went straight forward. As for the likeness of their faces, each had a face of a man. Each of the four had the face of a lion on the right side. Each had the face of an ox on the left side. Each had the face of an eagle. We're going to see those four again in Revelation. Okay? Their wings stretched upward. Two wings, each one touched one another, and two covered their bodies. And one went straight forward. They went wherever the spirit wanted to go, and they did not turn when they went. I mean, obviously, he is describing something he can't describe. So I'm not going to read all this. It goes down to verse 25. In verse 18, it says, as for their rims, they were so high, they were awesome, and their rims were full of eyes all around the four of them. So remember, Revelation is going to say they have eyes in front and behind. When the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them, and when the earth they lifted up, wherever the spirit wanted to go, they went because the spirit went, and the wheels were, I mean, he is trying to describe a heavenly scene using heaven. We're using earthly words. Isaiah had some of the same problem. John is going to have some of the same problem in Revelation. It's not, we don't have a vector point for it, right? I mean, how do you describe this? So I want to be clear, these aren't animals. So they have a face like. He's trying to use a metaphor or a simile to say something that his reader might be familiar with, but he's looking at something and going, I don't know how to describe this. How am I taking that and putting it in a description? So those who deny that they would allegorize this say, see, this is impossible. He's just smoked too much hash the night before, you know, that kind of a thing. No, he's seeing a real thing, a real angelic being. And a cherub is not this little child. You know, we see a cherub over a nursery, over a cradle, this little child, and we see it in medieval art. That's not at all what a cherub looks like. It's not. For sure. So it'd be like if an amoeba could talk. Asking the amoeba to explain principal, interest, and tax and insurance on your house. I mean, this is the gulf we're talking about. If we believe what the Bible says, and I do, that God created, we now think, 2 trillion galaxies in an instant of time by saying, let matter exist. Right? Then what do we... So yes, I think having this understanding, I won't go to chapter 10, and you can read that if you're curious. So I make the point, and I must be done. These are not animals. The Greek word used in Revelation literally just means to live. In other words, they're living creatures. They're not animal. They're not like... That's not what they are. They're not an ox. They're like an ox. They are described in detail in the above Ezekiel passage. These are an exalted form of angel. Remember, the cherubim guarded Eden after Adam's sin. They covered the Ark of the Covenant. If you've seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know that. that was a little joke. Okay. They covered the Ark of the Covenant, and Satan was one of them. Ezekiel 28, if you want to go there. Ezekiel 28, because most people ask me, was Satan really an angel? I go, well, there's a couple of references that seem to indicate that. Ezekiel 28 is one of those. Ezekiel 28, verse 14. And he said... So let's go back, verse 11. Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Ezekiel 28, 11, Son of man, take up a lamentation for the king of Tyre. Tyre was a city in southern modern-day Lebanon. And say to him, thus saith the Lord, you are the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. In other words, the king of Tyre, the literal king of Tyre, was a very wicked, vile man and hated the Jews. There's going to be a metaphor to Satan, and he's going to use this human instrument that hated the Jews to be a metaphor for Satan himself. Because this obviously is not a description of a human. Okay? You were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden. So was the current king of Tyre, when Ezekiel wrote, was he in Eden? Well, of course not. He said, you were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering. So all the stones that we see about on the breastplate of the chief of priests. So Satan, as a cherub, was covered. He would have dazzled. So the light, when we talk about the God being light, brilliant light, then, I mean, you know, a great ring, you know, a girl gets engaged and, you know, the fiance, and she's looking at her ring and the light, and it sparkles in the light, and can you imagine a body, that your whole body is diamonds and sapphires and rubies, and how you would sparkle in the light of God? And isn't that what glory is? It's the visible manifestation of the essence of God. We are to reflect the glory of God. He was the perfect reflection of the glory of God. Satan was. Okay? He said, every precious stone was your covering, the sardis, the topaz, and diamond. Beryl, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, turquoise, emerald, with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you on the day you were created. In other words, Satan is an incredibly credible musician. That's why when people say to me, do you think Satan has music? I said, of course. Does Satan have music in our world today? Well, of course he does. Go listen to Taylor Swift. When Taylor Swift stands up last week and gets her entire crowd of teeny bopper girls to scream, F the patriarchy. And the entire concert was screaming, F the patriarchy. Taylor Swift is the most powerful theologian in the world today. I want you to let that sink in. Because music is the greatest way. So why did I sing with our kids every day? Lorna was here. Every day I sang for 15 minutes in early, and then about 5 minutes before my story. Jesus loves me. Do you know that you've been born again? Washed in the blood of the Lamb. What? Because they will, So my little newly turned, just turning three next week, grandson, he's singing Jesus Loves Me. He asked if he could pray last night, and my little three-year-old said, "Dear Jesus, thank you for dying on the cross for my sin. I want to go to heaven." That was his prayer over his meal. Thank you for the food. Amen. His parents didn't teach that to him. I didn't teach that to him. That's what he's picked up in places like Vacation Bible School and Sunday School and bedtime stories. And he's just now turning three. John? Yes. So when people say, well, there can't be bad music, I say, are you kidding me, Satan? Look at what it says. He says, the workmanship of your timbrels and pipes. Timbrels. It's you know, a timbrel. Your pipes. Don't we say sometimes with a singer, they have incredible pipes? I mean, yep. He said, you were anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. You were perfect in all your ways from the day you were created till iniquity was found in you. By the abundance of your training, you became filled with violence within, and you sinned. Therefore, I cast you out. I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. Have you seen the recent? I just saw something on X, and it's a bunch of women bragging about how many Botox injections they've had. 76, 42, I love it, 55. They're taking after their father, the devil, because they're infatuated with their beauty. There's nothing wrong with, okay, not to offend anybody, but my dad used to say, you know, there's nothing wrong with a little paint on the barn. It's okay to put a little paint on the barn. There's nothing wrong with that. Okay, ladies, don't stone me. It's my deceased father that said that. Okay, get mad at him. I'm just the messenger. There's a difference between being attractive and then being insanely worshipful of your own beauty. That you lift your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. I laid you before kings that they may gaze at you. You defiled your sanctuaries by the multitude of your iniquities, by the iniquity of your trading. Therefore, I brought fire from your midst and devoured you, and I turned you to ashes upon the earth in the sight of all who saw you. All who knew you among the people are astonished at you. You have become a horror, and you shall be no more forever. Oh, I am way late. Okay, I just went through to show you Satan was a cherub. I don't know if any of you have ever seen that before or done that or understood that passage, but okay.